Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1 with It's for Women. The car insurance with extra benefits like personal accident cover. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1 with It's for Women. The car insurance with extra benefits like personal accident cover.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there, and you're very welcome to the programme. Well, coming up in the next hour, I'm going to be joined by the brilliant investigative journalist and former MP Chris Mullen, who worked tirelessly to free the Birmingham Six and who this week won his case to protect his sources, including the identity of the real bomber. Also today, I'm 60, I'm older, and I'm not the right shape and size, following her surprise but hugely popular win as Best Actress at the BAFTAs last week. I'll be chatting with the UK's new national treasure, Joanna Scanlon, including about her Irish roots, and we'd have some great music and chat from Grotham Kyo's Musician of the Year, Paddy Glacken. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on anything featured on the programme. You can text us to 51551, you can email Miriam at rt.ie, or you can tweet at Miriam O'Call. First, though, this morning, on November the 21st, 1974, 21 people were killed and around 200 injured when bombs exploded in two Birmingham pubs, the Mulberry Bush and Tavern in the Town. Six men were subsequently imprisoned for the bombings before journalist Chris Mullen's investigation helped overturn their wrongful convictions in 1991. Well, this week, in an historic freedom of the press case at the Old Bailey, a British judge ruled that Chris Mullen is within his rights not to hand over information that could identify the person who is responsible for the Birmingham pub bombings. He argued that his interview with the bomber was granted on the basis that he would never reveal the man's identity. And journalist and former MP and government minister Chris Mullen joins me now. Morning to you, Chris. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning, Miriam.
Look, congrats on that victory, and I'll come back to it. Do you mind, for my listeners, Chris, could we go back briefly to 1974? When did you first start reporting on what had happened in Birmingham, or how did the case come to your attention?
A friend of mine, who was a journalist on the Guardian newspaper, Peter Chippendale, reported the trial, and he remarked to me at the time that he thought they got the wrong people, and he came to that conclusion both from his attendance at court and I think from chatting to one or two of the relatives. So my interest was aroused from that time onwards, really.
And can you tell me about your work then? I think it was with World in Action, and how it was you became aware that the West Midlands Police, that they had got the wrong men.
Well, when Peter Chippendale raised the issue with me at the time, I wasn't in a position to do very much about it, but I just sort of kept a weather eye on the case. And, of course, they appealed. Two Catholic priests published a pamphlet setting out their version of events, and the men continued to protest their innocence. And then eventually, at the beginning of the 1980s, I persuaded a publisher to commission a book on the case, but I still didn't have the resources to carry out a proper investigation. And it was only when I persuaded World in Action, which was the premier documentary series at that time, Granada Television's documentary series, to take me on to conduct a proper investigation, that it was possible to do so.
And I think relevant to this week's case, Chris, as part of your investigation down the years, you found that in order to prove the man's innocence, you'd really have to track down the actual bombers. Can you talk me through, do you mind, how you went about meeting with those men who were actually responsible for the bombings?
Well, I realised at an early stage that one could go on knocking down the case against the six men until the cows came home, but that wouldn't prove they didn't do it. It would just prove that the case against them was weak, and that if you wanted to prove they didn't do it, you had to track down those who were responsible and persuade some or all of them to describe what they'd done in sufficient detail to make it impossible for the authorities to go on alleging that they got the right people. And that's what I set out to do.
And Did they, when you met them, they confirmed to you, did they, Chris, that none of the six Birmingham, as we've known them now, had in any way been involved with the bombings?
Well, I basically went about establishing contact with the people who had been responsible. I went to Sinn Féin, first of all, and I said to them, because they knew as well as everybody else that the wrong people were inside, and I said to them that I thought the time had come to put this right. And I didn't want them to direct me towards any particular individuals, nor did they. But what I said to them was, I gave them some names. I said, this is the guy I want to talk to, and I'd be grateful if you tell him you've got no objections. And they did, and I started with Michael Murray, whose name had been mentioned from the outset as being one of those involved and who had served 12 years in prison in the UK for involvement in Birmingham bombings and had long been suspected of having been involved in the pub bombings. He wasn't at all keen to meet me, as you might imagine, but was eventually persuaded to do so. And I interviewed him three times in the end, and he agreed that, well, he told me that he gave me an account of the bombings, that he was one of four people who'd been responsible, that two people put both bombs in both pubs, that he was one of two people who made the bombs, and that he also made the warning call, which was botched. And, of course, that didn't... That was very useful. He didn't name any other names. Actually, he did name one other. One name slipped out by accident. But the basis of the interview was that he wouldn't name the other people. And I realized, of course, that merely saying I'd met the man who made the bombs wouldn't solve the problem, because the police had never said they got the people who made the bombs. Indeed, they never really offered any explanation as to where the bombs came from. So I would have to find one of the planters, one of the two men who planted the bombs, and that was a much trickier operation. And basically, I interviewed 16 or 17 of those people who'd been planting bombs in and around Birmingham or in the West Midlands in the mid-1970s. Some of them had been in jail at the time when the pubs were bombed, and so they didn't necessarily know who'd done it, but they did know which of their colleagues had been left outside, had been at liberty on the night of the bombings, 21st of November 1974. And so I gradually grew up a short list of possible suspects, and then I worked my way around those until I came to the bomber.
And, I mean, I think he agreed to speak to you, but Chris, only on condition that you would, of course, he would remain anonymous.
Well, that was the condition, really, on which all the, as I say, I spoke to 16 or 17 people who'd been in that line of business in the West Midlands, and none of them are going to cooperate with me if I said, well, I can't guarantee not to hand over all the details to the police. Not that the police were at all interested, I should say. The only way in which they will cooperate is in return for an absolute guarantee that I wouldn't disclose their names. And in particular, of course, that was the case with the chap who turned out to be the bomber. He wasn't actually minded to tell me the truth even when I first appeared on his doorstep. His line was that he'd known something big was going to happen that night, and he'd been warned to stay at home, and that he'd been at home. But, of course, it's a very big secret to have harboured all those years that you're the person who put the bombs in the pubs that killed all those people. And it was apparent, and he hadn't told anybody else before, I don't think. And he was in a very nervous state, and as he was telling me about his life and times in the West Midlands IRA, his voice got more and more trembling, and eventually I just said to him, I think you were in the pubs, and then it all came tumbling out.
And this is almost like a side question, Chris, but as you speak there, do you think somebody like that man was racked with guilt or
yes.
not?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, yes, no, it was apparent from his demeanour. See, he'd only been very young at the time. He was about 19 or 20, and he was very much the junior partner. He just got called and told he was wanted for an operation. He'd been involved in other bombings in the Birmingham area, and all of the previous ones had been against commercial properties, and nobody, although in one case I think a bomb disposal expert was killed, there'd been about 50 bombings, but in in apart from the bomb disposal expert, nobody had been killed. And they always gave warnings, and sometimes they aborted bombings when it was thought there was too big a risk to people. But he didn't know what the targets were when they set out walking down into town, each carrying a bag, two of them, one man much older than him, much more experienced. And he said he only really learned about the targets during the course of the walk down into town. And then he started saying, but these are crowded. No, they were two pubs, crowded pubs in Birmingham. He started arguing with the other guy, and the other guy kept assuring him that not to worry, there'd be plenty of warning, and all those people would be out of there. Well, of course, the warning went wrong, and the people weren't out of there, and the bombs went off, and so many people were killed and injured. So that was his story, and which I believe. I mean, it was it's a very big secret, as I say, to have harboured all those years, and he was very agitated.
But what you managed to do by finding and speaking to someone who acknowledged in the end they had planted the bomb was that these other six men had had nothing to do with it. And you mentioned it earlier, your book, your wonderful book, The 1986 Error of Judgment, you revealed everything about that in that book. But what was the West Midlands Police response to your revelations at that time, Chris?
Well, there was no investigating going on when I came on the scene. Birmingham was in denial, even after the book was published. You know, I went to Birmingham's main bookshop in New Street, and I found two copies of my book under on a shelf labelled Irish Interest. That's how interested Birmingham was. So they were in denial, and I remember the crime reporter on the Birmingham Post and Mail, who was virtually the first person I visited when I started looking into this. He said, told me he'd never even heard it suggested that the wrong people had been put away. Well, it had been suggested quite vociferously many times in the 12 years previously, but he just hadn't noticed. The West Midlands Police, their reaction was, oh, well, we never said we got all of them. There must be one or two that got away that Mr. Mullins's been talking to. That's when pressed, they kept silence was the initial approach. But then the Home Office insisted that they come and interview me, and an assistant chief constable came and interviewed me. And his opening words to me were, we've been dragged here by the scruff of the neck by the Home Office. That's how keen they were to go down this path.
Granada TV, you know, who, as you say, they were just great around this. They then upped the ante. And I think the actual bomber then was interviewed in 1990. And they also broadcast, I think, a drama doc, Chris, Who Bombed Birmingham, in which I think you were played by John Hurt. And did this all prompt another inquiry?
We made a series of documentaries, first of all. The first one demolished the forensic evidence. The second one blasted a hole in the confession evidence. And the third one, as you say, consisted, and this was done in very difficult circumstances, consisted of an interview with the actual bomber, heavily disguised. And yes, all of that did have an impact. But what tracking down the actual perpetrators, what that enabled me to do was to confront the lie that the right people were in jail, because, as I said, you could go on knocking down forever the forensic evidence or the confession evidence. It didn't show they didn't do it. It just showed the case against them was weak. To show they didn't do it, you had to find the perpetrators, and that's what I did. And that meant that even in many years that followed, after the convictions were quashed, a lot of very senior judges and policemen of all ranks went around saying, oh, well, we know they really did it. And that even one or two national newspapers encouraged that view. But that enabled me to look them in the eye and say, no, that these people are entirely innocent. And indeed, I knew from all the interviews, I conducted 16 or 17 of them, that not merely did they have nothing to do with the pub bombings, but they'd never been members of the IRA or even members of Sinn Féin.
The day the men were released, Chris, I think I read you said standing with them was one of the proudest days of your life. What do you remember of that day?
Oh, that was a very big event, because when the convictions collapsed and the men were freed, it was in March 1991. By this time, it had become quite a cause célèbre. It was their second reference back to the Old Bailey, the appeal court at the Old Bailey. And by the time the appeal was coming to an end, there were crowds lining the streets and a wall of cameras from around the world waiting. And these guys, of course, came out the front door of the Old Bailey. It was a highly emotional moment. They hadn't they'd been in prison for 17 years. Even that morning, they'd arrived in the prison van, escorted by armed policemen, as if they were terrorists. And they came out the front door in civilian clothes. It was a wonderful, wonderful moment. And it went round the world. Even my wife's family in Saigon, in Vietnam, saw it on television.
Oh, well done to you. Now, the case before the Old Bailey this week, just explain to my listeners, did that come about, Chris, because the West Midlands Police, almost 50 years on, have reopened the investigation and they were trying to get you to reveal the name of the bombers? Is that essentially what this case was about?
Well, it is essentially. What had happened was that there's quite a vociferous campaign in the West Midlands. Since people have begun to accept that the wrong people were convicted, to find the actual perpetrators, and it's headed by relatives of some of the victims. And they did press the authorities to hold an inquest after all these years, and in 2018 an inquest was held into what had happened. And they wanted to do that as a way of leveraging another investigation. And so after the inquest, the West Midlands Police did start another investigation, and as far as I can see, it's a serious and professional investigation, unlike some of the ones that preceded it. And it has to be said that the present generation of West Midlands policemen, of course, are not implicated in the sins of their predecessors. So they've conducted really a pretty thorough investigation, but they still haven't managed to get evidence that would lead to the conviction of any particular individual. I should say that of the four, two are dead and two are still alive, the four culprits. One of those, I've interviewed all of them, only two of them confessed to me, and one of the others who is still alive is living in Dublin, and I've no evidence against him. He didn't own up to me. And then there's the one who did. So they wanted me to disclose his name and to provide the notes at the interview, and also they wanted actually access originally to all my notes of interviews with other people too, and I did cooperate with them insofar as I could without disclosing the identity of the sources, because I hold no brief for people who plant bombs in public places, but I couldn't disclose the names. And I refused to do so, which is it's a fairly fundamental principle of journalism. And I can't change my mind. Nobody, as I say, nobody would have talked to me if I'd have not given guarantees of anonymity. And I can't change my mind now just because it's convenient. So I didn't.
And I suppose you feel strongly as well, don't you, Chris, that if you were forced to reveal your sources, which, you know, is the basis of so much press freedom in a democracy, that the Birmingham 6 miscarriage of justice and other miscarriages of justice might never have been exposed?
Well, it would make life difficult. They took out an action against me under the Terrorism Act, and it would make life difficult, of course, for investigative journalists in any terrorism case in the future if I'd been forced to reveal my sources. Not that I would have been forced to. I would not have done so under any circumstances. It's, as I say, a cardinal principle of journalism in a democracy. And I had the full support of the National Union of Journalists and other colleagues in the profession, so I wouldn't have given way.
And Chris, you said, you know, just a few moments ago, you've, of course, no truck with bombers or people who carried out horrendous terrorist acts. So do you have sympathy? I've actually interviewed some of the families of the victims of those bombings, and obviously they come at it completely differently from their perspective. They just want the people who killed or maimed their loved ones exposed. So do you understand why they might feel unhappy with you?
I perfectly do. I think some of them have got a bit over the top in their unhappiness. I get a certain amount of abuse online, And I noticed one the other day, it's not one of the relatives, said I was worse than the bombers. But I don't respond to abuse, but I do respond to rational dialogue. But yes, I do understand that from the perspective of the relatives of the victims, this is not, protection of sources doesn't seem such an important principle. What matters to them is that they want to see, even after all these years, justice for their loved ones. I do certainly understand all that.
I assume it must have been a relief for you to win your case. I mean, Chris, you cannot believe, almost 50 years on, that the Birmingham 6 case is still such a big part of your life.
Well, of course, it had major implications, not just for that particular, one of the biggest miscarriages of justice in the UK. There were plenty of others. It led to the winding up of the West Midlands Serious Crime Squad. It led to a Royal Commission, which, among other things, set up the Criminal Cases Review Commission, and which has since quashed another 500 convictions. And it led to a sea change, I think, amongst police and the judiciary in their attitude towards evidence and the handling of evidence, and indeed the forensic evidence turned out to be very dodgy as well. So it had an enormous impact. That's why I would argue that what I did was fundamentally in the public interest. I have no problem with that. I knew I was acting in the public interest overwhelmingly. It cannot have been in the public interest to allow what happened to go unchallenged.
Well, Chris Mullen, congratulations to you, firstly, for winning your case this week, and also for your decades of campaigning that led to the freeing of the Birmingham Six. And I really appreciate you taking the time to speak to me this morning.
OK, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Chris. Take care.